everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Oi with the Terror. I'm one of your hosts, Sandra.
And I am the other host, Danielle.
And we are back.
Talking about Game of Thrones finale. And I said the guards and the dragons should have been in hot air balloons.
Yeah. I don't know if that would still work, though. Because, like, if you have dragons, like, I don't know. I just also am like, 14's a little young to be sent off on your own, on your dragon, during a war. Just personal opinion.
And this is a recap of the last episode for anyone who hasn't seen.
The finale. Oh, shit. Sorry. Spoiler alert if you haven't seen the episode yet. But
there's a dragon fight.
Yeah. It was actually a really cool dragon fight, although one of that dragon was huge. Like, massive.
Yeah, I was curious about the different size options for dragons. Because, like, they're different strengths and whatnot. Like, they're not all the same. So, like, I wanted more info on that. When someone claims a dragon, will they know how strong they are, or fast, or whatever?
Yeah, I was curious about that, too. I was also trying to figure out if it's an age thing, if they get bigger as they get older. And, like, when are they fully... Like, obviously they get bigger as they get older. I mean, we saw that in Game of Thrones with Daenerys' dragons. Mm-hmm. But, like, when are they, like, full size, I guess?
And this is the same dragon... What's his name? Aemon. The dragon he has, a giant one, wasn't that the same one that Daemon's wife, ex-wife, committed suicide with?
Yep. Mm. Yep, because she was in labor, and it wasn't... progressing.
So this dragon's like notorious.
Yeah. But
another spoiler, but
well, I feel like we've talked about this show a few times, so but for those of you that were waiting until the finale, you can now go and just watch the whole thing and binge instead of being like us and waiting every week to watch it.
I think we just gave a pretty good synopsis, so I don't think anyone needs to watch. Hot air balloons, dragons, someone committing suicide by dragon.
Yeah. Yeah. So, do you have an oi or an ooh of the week?
Not really. I went to my chiropractor today and she said that my neck and back look less tight, so I guess that's an ooh.
That's good.
Ah, Tim's tail. Tim just went by and his tail hit my leg and I didn't know what it was and I got scared.
Classic Tim.
He's so stealthy.
He is stealthy for a huge cat.
He's like as big as the giant dragon in this show.
He's huge. Every time I see him, I forget how big he is. And it's,
Yeah, I think he's 18 pounds?
20.
Lean. Dave says 20. Hashtag Dave the intern.
Dave the cat wearer. Some of my intern duties.
Oh, he's back. So yeah, I guess my ooh of the week as a chiropractor was impressed. But yeah, you can go.
Okay, I don't really have an ooh. Well, I had a Halloween party and that was fun. But... And I hope this is the last time I'm going to have to say anything about a celebrity death, because I feel like this is becoming a theme now, is, I don't know if you know this actor. You might not. Leslie Jordan.
I think I saw a photo of him. He's like a comedian.
Yeah. He was on like Will and Grace. He was on, it's a show with that girl from the Big Bang Theory. Call Me Cat, I think.
I feel like he may have been in American Horror Story. I think I saw him in an episode of something.
So, yeah, he's been in a lot of stuff, actually. He's been around for a while, but I know him mostly from Will and Grace. And I found out today when I was at work that he passed away. I think it was like a motorcycle accident.
Oh, really? What's his last name?
Jordan.
Oh. Oh, yeah, a car crash.
Yeah, he crashed his vehicle into the side of a building, which is sad. He was an American Horror Story.
Okay.
And he was, okay, and it is Call Me Cat, and he was also a guest judge on The Masked Singer. So, my condolences to his family and friends and everything. It's just really sad that he passed away so kind of unexpectedly. And hopefully, next week, I will not say any more celebrity deaths, because that's the third, and they usually come in threes.
Yeah, this is like your new weekly segment or something.
Yep. So
Sandra's celebrity death quarter.
So hopefully, they come in threes, so hopefully this is the last one for a while, but I do, you know, condolences to anybody that knows him personally, professionally, and his family and friends and everything, because it was just unexpected.
Yeah, that's sad. So that's your oi.
That's my oi. Well, I don't know if it's really an oi, just kind of like an...
Celebrity Death Corner.
Yeah, I don't want to have a segment called Celebrity Death Corner. So please, celebrities, stay alive.
I feel like we won't hear anything until January. I don't know if you've noticed, but I feel like the past few years there have been a lot of celebrity deaths in January.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, New Year. It's usually when a lot of people pass, or the end of the year.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like end of December, early January is when a lot of people pass away.
Hmm.
So, anyway, that's my sad oi. And, yeah, I don't really have an ew.
Okay.
Because I didn't think of one. So, there's that.
Ready for your part two.
All right, everyone, buckle up for part two.
Maybe they're still buckled up from the first part.
I mean, that'd be great if they were. Make my life a little bit easier.
Don't take that buckle off yet.
I have to find also where I stopped. Okay, that's where I stopped. Okay, so just to kind of reiterate everything from last week very quickly. Again, the topic is the Salem Witch Trials. And last week or last episode, it mostly touched on the girls and who they accused, as well as why they accused them. And this week, it's basically just the accusations at this point, at least with me explaining it, are kind of done. And it's going to move into more of like what happened after everybody was accused and like recently as well. So the first person that was executed was Bridget Bishop, and she was executed on June 10th. Then on July 19th, Sarah Good, Elizabeth Howe, Susanna Martin, Rebecca Nurse, and Sarah Wilds were executed as well. And I believe Bridget Bishop was the only person that was executed on her own. Everybody else who had an execution, except for one other person, who I'll get into a little bit later, was more of a group execution. So these group executions would actually draw a lot of crowds to witness the hangings. That is how essentially that, at least over here in the States, is how witches or people that were accused as witches would die, was via hangings. It was really more in the UK and Europe where they would burn them. So that's kind of the biggest difference between Europe and the US. So like I said, they would draw in a lot of crowds, especially a lot of people from Boston that would actually travel from Boston all the way up to Salem to watch the people get executed. And the last execution day was September 22nd, and the people that were hanged were Martha Corey. Her husband Giles Corey was also killed 3 days earlier, and I'll get into him a little bit later because he's a little bit of a different story. It also included Mary Eatsy, Alice Parker, Mary Parker, and Pewditer, Wilmot Red, Margaret Scott, and Samuel Wardwell. There was Reverend Nicholas Noyes, who actually quoted, "What a sad thing it is to see 8 firebrands of hell hanging there." The sad thing also about the people that were executed is because they could not actually afford a proper burial, they were essentially cut down after death and then placed in a nearby crevice, which acted as a shallow grave. People do speculate, at least for family members particularly, that those of George Jacobs, Rebecca Nurse, and John Proctor came to the site under cover of darkness to retrieve the bodies of their loved ones and then would bury them on family property. But according to historian Emerson Baker, and I quote, "There are no human remains in the very shallow soils of Proctor's Ledge." So essentially what would happen is the people that were executed wouldn't even really get a proper burial. They would just kind of be thrown into what we would call basically a ditch or a hole and just be left there, which just kind of shows what the people really thought of the people that were accused, because normally people would receive a proper burial. So then we fast forward to September of 1692. So in September, the grand juries did indict 18 more people. It did fail to indict William Proctor, who was rearrested on new charges. September 19th, 1692 was also the day that Giles Corey, who, if you remember that I mentioned, was the husband of Martha Corey, who was hanged on September 22nd. Giles Corey refused to actually plead at the trial, and because he essentially believed, from what I understand from the documentary that I saw and the ghost tour that we went on, because he thought that if he just didn't say anything, there was nothing they could really do to him because he wouldn't plead at the trial. However, he was actually subjected to a form of torture. Excuse my pronunciation. I'm going to see if I can pronounce this correctly. So the form of torture was referred to as the pipe fort et dure, which is a form of torture where the subject is pressed beneath an increasingly heavy load of stones in an attempt to actually make him enter a plea. Of those 18 people that were indicted, there were 4 that pleaded guilty, and 11 others were tried and then found guilty. So essentially what happened to Giles Corey is, because he refused to, again, plea, they essentially just put stones on his body, and he still refused to plea. He still refused to really say anything, and it was believed that the last words he may have said were, and I quote, "more weight," because he would have rather have been crushed to death by stones than plea at his trial, essentially. So then it was on September 20th that Cotton Mather wrote to Stephen Sewell, and he said, and I quote, "that I may be the more capable of assist in lifting up a standard against the internal enemy." He is requesting, and I quote, "a narrative of the evidence given in at the trials of half a dozen, or if you please, a dozen of the principal witches that have been condemned." Then on September 22nd, 1692, there were 8 more persons that were executed. And I do believe that was around the last of the executions, if I'm remembering correctly. But let me just double check that. Yeah, the last execution day was September 22nd. So after all of this has happened, and after so many people have been accused, so Dorcas Hoare was given a temporary reprieve with the support of several ministers to make a confession of being a witch. There was another person by the name of Mary Bradbury, who was 77 at the time, who actually managed to escape with the help of family and friends. Abigail Faulkner Sr. Was pregnant and given a temporary reprieve. Some reports that say that that Abigail's reprieve later became a stay of charges. Maher quickly completed his account of the trials, Wonders of the Invisible World, and then it was given to Phipps when he returned from the fighting in Maine in early October. And then, so then basically the last trial was held in May of 1693, and the public response to these events continued. In the decades following the trials, there were survivors and family members and their supporters that sought to establish their innocence of the individuals who were convicted and to gain compensation. It was in the following centuries that the descendants of those unjustly accused and condemned have sought to honor their memories. There are events in Salem and Denver that happened in 1992 that were used to commemorate the trials because it was the 300-year anniversary. And then in November of 2001, years after the celebration that happened in 92, the Massachusetts legislature actually passed an act that exonerated all who had been convicted in naming each of the innocent, with the exception of Elizabeth Johnson, who was actually cleared by the Massachusetts Senate on May 26, 2022. And she was the last convicted to be reversed after pressure from, believe it or not, school children who actually discovered the anomaly. And the trials have figured in American culture, and they have been explored in numerous works of art, literature, and film, which I'll get into in a little bit. Essentially, during the Salem witch trials, during that basically year, there were more than 200 people that were accused of practicing witchcraft, and of those 200 people, 20 of those people were executed, and most were executed by hanging, which is crazy to think about. Mm-hmm. So essentially what happened at the end of the trials is that, from what I understand, no one, like, it got really out of hand, and it just got to the point where everybody was getting accused, and it just kind of felt like no one was really, like, they were all kind of, like, tired of it. So they really wanted to find a way to kind of stop it. And I think also what helped, and at least what I understood from a documentary that I watched, which will be in the notes of the episode, the girls also kind of realized that, like, their tricks or whatever weren't really working anymore. And it all just kind of faded away after time. And although it faded away after time, and unfortunately did not fade away in history. So, like I said, this one event that essentially was caused basically by a couple of girls, they ruined about 200 people's lives. And of those 200 people, there were 20 that were essentially killed because of their actions, which is crazy to think about. Looking into a little bit past the history and more into, like, there are theories, there are medical theories that may have explained the girl's afflictions a little bit more. Essentially, the cause of the symptoms of those that claim to have an affliction does continue to be a subject of interest, because there have been various medical and psychological explanations for the observed symptoms that had been explored by researchers. These include hysteria, maybe that was in response to all of the Native American attacks. The convulsions may have been caused by eating rye bread made from grain that was infected by fungus, which I think Danielle and I talked a little bit about last week. So that was a theory, that they may have had something in the bread that may have caused them to have these episodes or these side effects. It may have been an epidemic of a bird-borne, and I guess a bird-borne disease, or even sleep paralysis, which may have explained, like, the nocturnal attacks that some of the accusers alleged to have. Some modern historians are less inclined to focus on the biological explanations and are preferring to explore motivations. So I kind of also mentioned this a little bit last week as well. These motivations may have included jealousy, spite, and the need for attention, because they did grow up in a Puritan society, and in Puritan society, that is a very rigorous society, very rigorous rules and expectations. But people obviously still had feelings like jealousy or spite or just wanting to have attention. And what better way to have attention than to just start convulsing in a courtroom and saying that you're having all of these problems and that you're having, you know, visions. And also, these girls were relatively young as well, so they may have just been acting like typical girls, but because of the society that they grew up in, that may have deemed, you know, to be kind of inappropriate. So, obviously, because Salem is still such a popular topic, it is in a lot of pop culture. For instance, I think most everybody recognizes the Crucible. That seems to be, like, the main piece of culture that is tied to the Salem witch trials. For those of you that don't know, The Crucible is a play by Arthur Miller that he wrote back in 1952, and it's loosely based on actual events that Betty or Elizabeth Paris and other characters faced during the actual Salem witch trials, and that was talked about also on the Ghost Tour, I believe. There's also been films like Assassination Nation, which was back in 2018. There are movies like Hocus Pocus, which came out in 1993, Paranorman, which came out in 2012. There are TV shows such as Motherland Fort Salem, which came out in 2020, Bewitched, which is another very popular one that ran from 1964 to 1972. And then others include American Horror Story Coven, which was back in 2011. And then Salem, which aired from 2014 to 2017, and that starred Shane West. One of the things I really also wanted to look into is what happened essentially to these main girls that were the ones that accused the most of the people to be a witch. And what I found out was that, at least for Ann Putnam, so she was one of the main accusers, and she actually, her testimony led to the death of 19 innocent people. So of the 20 people that were killed, 19 of them essentially were killed because of her testimony. She did inherit her land after her parents died when she was 19. So she became an orphan at the age of 19. And then she had to care for her orphan brothers and sisters. Out of all of the girls, essentially, that did accuse people of being witches, she is the only one to ever apologize to the congregation for her part of the trials. And she was, again, the only accuser to do so. None of the other girls did. She did pass away in 1716 and was buried in an unmarked grave. And then when she passed away, her four brothers ended up inheriting the land that she had from her parents. And just to kind of give you an idea, she was also one of 12. So the whole wanting attention or having jealousy could have also played a big part into her part as to why she may have accused people of being a witch. Then there's Mary Walcott. She was actually a step cousin to Ann Putnam Jr., and she was 16 when the witch trials began, and then she was 17 during the majority of the trials. She lived until around 1752, and she supposedly married and had many children, but because of the time period, it's really hard to kind of figure out what actually happened to a majority of these girls. So they're not really sure what exactly happened to her, but they can assume that, judging by what they found in history, that she was married and she did have children. The next is Mary Lewis. She was originally born in Falmouth, Maine, and she was actually a refugee from Maine due to her town being attacked by Native Americans back in 1689. After the attack, she was then placed as a servant in Thomas Putnam's house. Not much is known about her after the trials ended, but it is said that she had no remorse for her actions, and she may have had an illegitimate son in Boston. Abigail Williams, she lived with her uncle, Samuel Parris, after her parents were killed by Native Americans, and she only took part in 8 of the trials, and then she kind of disappeared during the trials, and no one really knows what happened to her after the witch trials ended. Then there's Elizabeth Parris, or Betty Parris. In 1693, the Salem witch trials ended. Betty Parris never retracted her accusations or made any acknowledgments. At the age of 27 in 1710, she married Benjamin Barron, who was, a trader and a shoemaker. And during that time of her marriage, her father did still care for her and her siblings. He provided her with household stuff to better furnish her home with Benjamin. He bought her silver, money, and basically, anything she needed at the time. She and the Baron did end up having 4 children, and their names were Thomas, Elizabeth, Catherine, and Susanna. She survived her husband by 6 years, and she died on March 21st, 1760, in Concord, Massachusetts, at the age of 77. And that is the conclusion of the Salem witch trials.
Nice job.
Thank you. That was a lot.
Yeah, I kind of zoned out after the the names.
Yeah, because there's so many names. There's so many names. So many people died or were accused, and it's just crazy.
Yeah. But yeah, it's kind of interesting to hear the, like, alternative theories, like the whole fungus mushroom.
Mm-hmm.
People were hallucinating thing, but yeah, I don't know. It's a lot, and I guess people still talk about it now, so, like, I don't know, people whose ancestors maybe, like, I just wonder how many of the descendants, like, might still live in the Salem area, and I don't know, maybe there are some family rifts still, because, like, that would be kind of interesting to find that out, but I'm assuming maybe most people by now, like, aren't in the area anymore. Like, who would have descended from original people?
Honestly, I have no idea. I do also want to add that Dorothy Good, who was the youngest person accused from what I could find, she was not one of the 20 that was killed. I do believe she was able to leave the jail eventually and move on with her life. I don't think she had an easy life because she was so little, but mm-hmm. I do believe she was not one of the 20 that were killed. So I just want to reiterate that.
This also reminds me of, like, the, I think it's in Rhode Island, the whole vampire, like, phenomenon over there, how everyone convinced that were convinced that vampires were a thing.
I mean, it, again, for me, I think it was a combination. I think it was a combination of the fear from the Native Americans who were attacking, and that is terrifying. So it was a combination of that. I think maybe something to do with their food, and I think their lifestyle. I mean, from what I know from the Puritans, they were very strict, very, like, no fun, no nothing. You go to church, you come home, you read the Bible, you do your chores, you go to bed, basically. And I think a combination of that might have influenced the girls to, like, think that they could, like, get attention, and then it just blew up. Like, they didn't know how to control it.
Mm.
It just seems like a little bit of, like, a perfect storm kind of situation.
Yeah. Everything was lined up.
Yeah. But it's a very sad part of history, and I'm kind of glad that Salem, in a way, does embrace it. But I wish that the people, like, the family members kind of got their, like, acknowledgement that or pardoned.
Yeah, it's strange that it got turned around and Salem ended up profiting from being known as the witch place. Like, interesting.
It's interesting because a lot of it technically happened in, like, now Danvers, Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
But people still go to Salem. But I do think it is, I mean, it's interesting, but it also makes sense that a lot of the girls that were involved or did a lot of the accusations didn't really leave Massachusetts. I'm kind of surprised because I feel like I would have tried to leave Mass. But again, back then, if you don't have family or if you know you get married really young or something, it might just be easier to stay. But
I don't get that either, because it's like, what was it like to be there after that time? Like, I would assume it would have been unpleasant. So,
well, I just think of, like, revenge. Like, what if you accuse, like, somebody, they get killed, and then their family is just like, I'm going to come after you because you accused my insert family member here of being a witch, and they weren't. So, yeah. I also think it's interesting how it just kind of, like, died down. I couldn't really find, like, there's a little bit on how it ended, but, like, it just kind of, like, slowly over time just stopped.
Well, didn't it, I think I remember hearing on the tour, one of the reasons it ended was because the girls were trying to accuse, like, the governor's wife or something.
Yes. That is a big thing that happened. They did try to accuse somebody very high up, and that person was like, hell no. Yeah. We're not doing this. This is not happening. And he was kind of the driving force to start to stop it because he's like, no.
Yeah. That would make sense.
You're reaching too far. So yeah, that is kind of like, that was kind of the first push to, like, get it to stop. And then it eventually did stop. Yeah, I did forget that part, my bad. But in my defense, there's a lot in the Salem Witch Trials. As you'll see from my sources that I used like 15.
Yeah, you covered the main points, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah, so. But it was interesting. I definitely learned a lot. And I hope that everybody enjoyed listening to it. I'm excited to not talk and let Danielle do the talking because I don't think you sent me a hint either, or you might have.
I said it was a disappearance.
Yeah, that's about all I got.
In the 80s/90s, but this one actually is, like, not really related to Halloween or anything, but it's a pretty well-known case, so I figured it would still be, like, a good one to hear. So this is the disappearance of Tara Calico. You might not know it just by the name, but when I talk about details, it might sound familiar.
Okay, yeah, off the bat, it doesn't ring really a bell.
So I have heard about this. Like, the reason I remembered it was because this is known for two creepy Polaroid photos that show a young woman being, like, bound, tied up with, like, duct tape over her mouth. And, like, everyone was basically torn on if this was the missing girl, Tara Calico. And it was basically, like, split. Some people thought it was her, and some people, like, weren't convinced. So there was a well-known photo that, like, there was a girl, a teenage girl, and a younger boy, and it looked like they were in the back of a van, and they were, like, tied up. So, and then there was a book next to the girl, and Tara's mom confirmed that that would have been a book she would have read, because she liked the author. So that was, like, a strange coincidence. And she also said she thought she saw a scar on the girl's leg in the photo that her daughter had. So the mom was convinced that that was her. But, yeah. And I just remember this from that photo because it was, like, shown everywhere, I think, in the news and everything. So it starts off in the 80s. On the morning of September 20th, 1988, 19-year-old Tara Calico left her home in Valencia County, New Mexico, to go on her daily bike ride. She typically rode along New Mexico State Road 47. This was a daily occurrence, and Tara's mother, Patty Dole, knew this because they would sometimes ride together. But Patty had not accompanied Tara lately because of a dangerous driver who drove very close to them one day. And this made her nervous about going on bike rides. But Tara continued and ignored her mother's suggestion to start carrying mace. So on this sunny morning, Tara headed out the door and jokingly told her mom to come looking for her if she didn't return by noon. She had a tennis date with her boyfriend at 12:30. But when noon rolled around, Tara was still gone. On the afternoon she disappeared, Patty drove up and down the bike route to find her daughter, but couldn't find her. She contacted the police. A few people said that they recalled seeing Tara along the road. One or two people remembered seeing a light-colored pickup truck that may have been riding near Tara. Pieces of her Walkman and a cassette tape were found by the police, and Patty was convinced they were dropped in pieces were dropped intentionally in her daughter's attempt to leave a trail. But Tara and her pink bike were not found. Police started questioning Tara's parents, John and Patty, about Tara's home life. Like in many other disappearances, police thought Tara was a runaway, but her family maintained that their daughter was always cheerful and always had things to do during her days and didn't seem like someone who would just take off and run away. John described his daughter like a machine who was constantly on the go. There were no updates in the disappearance of Tara Calico until almost 9 months later, on June 15, 1989. A strange Polaroid photo was found in a convenience store parking lot in Port St. Joe, Florida? Is that right? Port St. Joe. You know Florida, Sandra.
That doesn't sound familiar at all, but
okay.
Maybe? Yeah, there is a place in Florida called Port St. Joe. So I've just never heard of it.
Well, now we know.
I guess it's a very big fishing town.
Okay.
And I guess it's, like, near the Gulf. I don't know. I've never heard of it, but
it does exist.
Yeah, it exists. It's not St. John. It's St. Joe.
So this strange Polaroid photo was found in a convenience store there, parking lot, approximately 1,500 miles from where Tara had disappeared. The photo showed a teenage girl and a young boy clothed, lying on sheets in what looked like a makeshift bed in a van. They both had duct tape over their mouths and appeared to be bound. A woman who found the Polaroid called the police And she also saw a white Toyota van parked in the same location before she arrived. A man in his 30s, sporting a mustache, was the driver of the van. Police tried to block off the van from traveling any further, but this was unsuccessful. The picture garnered a lot of attention and was featured on the show America's Most Wanted. Patty's friends saw the girl in the photo, who looked very similar to Tara, and they told Patty that they should look at the photo. At first, Patty wasn't 100% convinced that this was her daughter, but after inspecting it closer, she changed her mind. The girl in the picture had a similar scar on her thigh, like the one Tara got from a car accident. Also, a book shown in the photograph next to the unknown girl was one Tara would have read normally. Patty became convinced that this was her daughter. Authorities, however, were not so sure. Experts at the Los Alamos National Lab studied similarities between Tara and the girl in the picture, but they could not make a conclusive determination. But when Scotland Yard took a look, they concluded that this was Tara Calico. It was determined that the Polaroid was taken recently, and because of the stock of the paper, it couldn't have been taken later than May because the stock wasn't available before May. Also, they didn't know who the young boy was in the picture. So the family of 9-year-old Michael Henley came forward to say they thought it was Michael. Michael had vanished in New Mexico in April 1988 while on a hunting trip with his father. In 1990, Michael's remains were found in New Mexico's Zuni Mountains, 7 miles from the campsite. But he died of exposure long before the Polaroid had been developed. In the decades since Tara Calico disappeared, her case has remained cold. In 2003, the Doles moved 2,000 miles away from New Mexico to Florida. Patty said, there's not anything I can do that doesn't remind me of Tara, end quote. In 2008, a new development popped up. Sheriff Rene Rivera from Valencia County, New Mexico, said he knew what happened and who did it. He said two teenagers were following Tara on her bike when some kind of accident took place, and he thinks the teenagers freaked out and disposed of her body. John Dole was angry when these claims were made without any plans to arrest the suspects. John thought the theory was based on circumstantial evidence. In the meantime, two other Polaroid photographs surfaced with young women who could have also been Tara Calico. One was a blurry photo of a girl's face with tape covering her mouth. It was found near a residential construction site in Montecito, California. It was taken after May 1989. The second picture was of a woman loosely bound with her eyes covered, sitting next to a man on an Amtrak train. It was roughly from February 1990. No ever charges were ever brought as a result of the images. Patty thought the Polaroid found in California could have been Tara. At this point, she had been missing for more than 30 years. And to this day, the disappearance of Tara Calico is considered to be one of the most haunting cold cases.
That's crazy.
Yeah. What's the story with all the creepy Polaroids?
Because they had Polaroids back then.
Yeah, they were all the craze in the 80s and 90s.
Well, it's just crazy to think about. Because, like, even today with, like, our technology and phones and everything, like, kids still, like, disappear and get taken. So it's, like, you know, you do kind of wonder, like, if they had the technology that we did, like, or do, would they have gotten, would they have still disappeared? Or, like, would they have been found? Or
and who are the other people that were bound and gagged and whatever?
Yeah. And are people looking for them? So,
yeah, you do hear about creepy stories, people getting, like, kidnapped while on a bike ride. Mm-hmm. There's another well-known case. I think it happened a few years ago. Maybe I'll do that one day. I can't think of her name off the top of my head. But I think it was kind of similar. She was also on a bike, and someone just, like, drove over and, like, took her.
Yeah. Well, I was watching yesterday. I was watching, I think it was a show on Netflix called Cold Cases. It's an older show. It was back in like 2017. And they were talking about a case that was solved, a cold case of a little girl. And she was walking home around Halloween in like a Halloween costume. It was 90s. Mm-hmm. It was like the year we were born. I think it was like 92. And just walking home from like a nursing home or something that her and the Girl Scouts were at.
Aw, that's so wholesome.
And she was taken. Yeah, but like somebody just pulled up next to her and three men grabbed her and that's it.
Mm-hmm. So that's why my mom would tell me I wasn't like, she's like, oh, don't do that, like anything outside or you'll get kidnapped.
My parents would say the same thing. They're like, no, like, don't do that. You're going to get kidnapped.
This is why we are the way we are.
But even now, like, even walking around, like, where I live, like, I always get nervous when a car suddenly pulls up next to me if I'm walking in that direction. Because I don't know what they could be a Lyft driver dropping somebody off. Like, I don't know what they're doing.
I've heard of these things, like, it's like it looks like a necklace, but if you push it or you press it multiple times, it like contacts the police or something like that.
Yeah, I actually have an app that does that. It's called Noonlight, and if I have it open and if I'm walking and if I feel unsafe, I just hold it and then like type in a code and the cops will like know exactly where I am and come.
Okay,
so it's a pretty cool app and it's free. So again, that app is called Noonlight for those of you that are interested. But, because, you know, I live in a city, and you don't know. I don't know people's intentions. But it's stories like this that, like, I do think of, like, our parents being like, you know, don't be stupid. Like, have a little bit of street sense.
Yeah, it's because of situations like this. Like, things happened in the 80s or 90s, and then we're the generation where, like, people were more, like, weary of strangers and whatnot, and they knew crimes existed.
Well, I just think about, like, my parents, because my parents grew up, my dad grew up in the 50s and 60s, and my mom grew up in the 60s and 70s, and my grandparents had no clue what they were doing. None. They would just be like, go outside, come home for dinner, come home when the streetlights turn on, which we don't even have in our hometown, but that's a whole other story. Like, they had no clue.
Yeah. It was like children raising children.
Mm-hmm. They were like, just go. Just get out of that. My grandmother would honestly look at my mom and be like, go and get out of the house. Like, I don't want to see you until 5.
That sounds like so much freedom, though.
Yeah, my mom loved it. She's like, I got to do so many cool things and so many things that my grandmother has still no clue about. But, like, she's like, looking back, she's like, some of it wasn't very smart, but, like, I survived. It was fine. Mm-hmm. Same with my dad.
Parents were too sheltered.
Well, your parents also grew up in another country. So maybe that's why.
Yeah, they couldn't afford to have fun.
I'm pretty sure. I know your parents. I'm pretty sure they had fun.
Maybe.
It is also weird to think of your parents as like teenagers. Smell. Good pick. Another spooky story.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to another episode of Away with the Terror. We release new episodes every Thursday. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and everywhere else you listen to podcasts. If you have any suggestions, you can email us at awaywiththeterroralready@gmail.com. And like and follow our posts and stuff on Instagram and Facebook. Away with the Terror. And Away with the Terror Already podcast.
And we will see you all next week. Happy almost Halloween, everybody.
Stay safe. Bye.